Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Will has a poor connection. He joins us anyway. Why is your connection poor?
I don't know. I'm hearing a lot of staticky stuff coming through.
That would be you. Are you okay. In a place where there's a poor connection?
No, my signal looks strong.
Okay. All right. Yep. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. Tim Lynch joins me. He doesn't have a weak connection. How are you, Tim? Tim? Earth to Tim? I hear something and then nothing. Yes. No. Stand by. News just in from the Associated Press. Six people have been charged with plotting to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. That'll fix our problems. I think Tim's there now. You there?
Yeah, I'm here now.
All right. And then Jeff Kenny joins me. Jeff, how are you?
Good, Mac. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. All right. Let's talk about the Navy's going to go to 500 ships. All right. And our own version of Alfred Thayer Mahan, Will Costantini. Will, what say you to that? I mean, the last time we talked about money and shipbuilding was when the SecDef would not submit the Navy's shipbuilding plan to Congress because he found that the financial estimates were not credible. So in light of that, the grandiose plan to get the 500 ships by 2045, what say ye to that?
Well, The blurb that was in the National Interest doesn't give a lot of detail, but there were a couple of lines in there that I thought were important that need to be expanded. It said a lot of those are going to be unmanned/uncrewed, i.e. drone ships.
Right.
And I think if that's the case, then what this is doing is it's recognizing the significant shortfalls in the Navy. Number one is manpower and the expense of manpower. And number two is the capital costs of carriers, LHDs, Aegis cruisers. And so it's going to be a lot of smaller unmanned ships to get you to 500. And you don't really know the ratio. It just seems to me, based on this story, that it's a very defensive strategy.
Explain that, because it would seem, on the face of it, we go to 500 ships. We're in their face. It's offensive. We're forward deployed. No.
Well, if it's a 500 ship construct of the current Navy, then that's like 16 carrier battle groups. As opposed to wherever we got now, 10 or 11 or something. But that's not what it's going to be. I sense it's going to be the same number of carriers or maybe less, and a bunch of much smaller ships. And I think there was a couple of lines in there about bottling up China at that first island chain. And it's interesting, the Mahan strategy is that you get a big fleet and you chase down the enemy's big fleet and you destroy it in one decisive battle. And that's how you gain control of the sea. And this is, as the author puts in there, sort of an anti-Mahanian strategy that we're not going to do that. We're going to bottle them up and make them ineffective, and I guess control the sea, the rest of the sea.
Is that just deterrence, and that we've evolved beyond like the one major, you know, the great line of ships confrontation, and is that simply? I don't see that as defensive. If it's deterrent because we're out there in greater numbers or making the cost too high. I would question the defensive posture in that.
And again, we're dealing on a newspaper account,
right.
Speech as opposed to detail, but I don't get a sense. There's going to be a bunch of these ships that are swarming forward to take on some sort of Chinese fleet to gain control to a further. Naval campaign. That's not how I read it in this, again, synopsis of a speech that's unclassified. So I'm for Rush, but again, it may be that we're looking at what are our strategic limitations to crew a 500 fleet on the current construct means you got to expand the manpower in the Navy by 50%, right? To go from whatever we're at 300 to 500, you got to have more than 50% more sailors, and actually you need more.
Uh-oh. Our connection.
Than that. Yeah, that ain't going to happen.
Okay. All right. Tim?
Just building on a current construct is absolutely undoable.
All right. Well, I'm going to hang up and call you back because you just cut in and out. So I'm going to see if we can get a better connection. And okay. We'll let Timmy
Sorry.
Go. No. I don't know if it's you or me, but everybody else seems to be good. Tim, how about you? Your thoughts on the Navy going to 500 ships, even if 100, 150 are drone-type ships? Your thoughts on that?
Well, he's specifically mentioning lower costing, smaller ships here. They also, in this article, specifically mentioned the Marine Corps and Army having the troops available in that island chain with anti-air, anti-ship capabilities to support that. I agree with Will. It's a strategically defensive setup. Because who's going to go on the offensive under the way that we're ultimately going to be designed? This unfortunately provides context to what the Commandant is doing, and provides him a significant amount of backup that we hadn't seen before. All we knew was their shipbuilding plan got turned back in as being incomplete, and now the Secretary of Defense is coming out and wanting to reset the entire debate for multiple cheap platforms that would go hand in glove with what the Commandant's trying to do. So at least now we see there's a little bit more to it than just some obscure war games we have no knowledge about.
He did, at the end of his speech, he did actually, in fact, when I was reading it yesterday, I'm reading it, I'm like, uh-oh, there's no mention of the Marine Corps in all of this. And then right at the end, he bombed in a segment about, and to the Marine Corps' force design, you know, I do support it, except there's some work to be done, blah, 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 whatever the hell that meant. All right.
Well, let us hope they're thinking about what happens when the defense works and now they've got to go do something offensively, and recognize that they need the capabilities that we're unfortunately shedding. I still don't see any. This is depressing in that it gives the ammunition to the Commandant's plans, and I have not seen anything that justifies them yet that would make me comfortable. And so this is very interesting. But now we got to start talking money, and that's where everything gets sort of complicated. If my experience from observing from afar of DC is any indicator.
Hold on. Let me just read what he said about the Marine Corps. He goes, I want to say in his speech, there's like 6 or 7 points. And hold on. Under the effort, blah, 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 blah. Beyond that, to start. Marine Corps. The Marine Corps, lastly, the 7th point he makes is the Marine Corps is currently in the process of implementing its force structure plan, and I support the Commandant's vision to recalibrate to great power competition. As such, we see a need for more amphibious warfare ships than previously planned in the 50 to 60 range, but more work needs to be done in this area as well. Now, it's kind of cryptic, but that's what he said. Jeff, your thoughts on the 500-ship United States Navy?
Well, because all the drone ships that Eric mentioned, I'm kind of like, I'm like skeptical, you know, about it's almost pie in the sky because between now and between now and 2035 is a long time. I mean, it doesn't seem like that long, but it's 15 years. It's that could be 3 administrations.
I think it's 2045 is 20, yeah, 500 ships by 2045.
Yeah, it's like if it's like what Tim is saying, I kind of agree with him, about it. But it seems so esoteric right now, that it's hard to really come down on either side of it. It's encouraging about the extra amphibs. I mean, that what a dream come true would be to have between 40 and 60 amphibs again, But I don't know if our force design, unless there's going to be a change in the force design based on this, I guess what should happen is some kind of overall strategic, brief that he gives or address that he gives that kind of lays out where we're going with this thing instead of like one service at a time coming up with their ideas. And then I guess Esper might look at his function being as having a thread that kind of binds them all together. But, some kind of overall strategy. How are we going to do this? Are we looking to to liberate places conquered, in the event of, a malign actor, i.e. China? Or are we looking at deterrence? Are we looking at both? I mean, what's the idea behind all this? That's my idea.
Got it. So you don't see this as anything to get excited about yet? How about the concept in here of the Jeep carrier again, right? That, I think all of us being interested in the Battle of Samar and the heavy lifting that the Jeep carriers did back in World War II, all of a sudden you're hearing it again in this concept for these, what did he call them? A mix of high low end carriers,
yeah,
and to be able to do what we need to do. We don't need the big hitter there all the time, so it might be the America class, big deck amphib with the F-35 on it. So I thought that was relatively one of the interesting parts of it, as he kind of laid out this this plan for 2045, and really, the blueprint for confronting China militarily, and this would be a big part of the initiative in Europe is the European Defense and Deterrence Initiative, I think is what it's known as, and this would be the twin, and this would be the major construct of the Navy to support both of those ends. So, anybody else relative to the Jeep carrier, Will?
I don't like that idea.
Hey, I would only.
Yeah, it again, though, just not sure how it fits in there and what the numbers are, because the America class has still got to be a $3 billion ship with a big crew on it. So if you're scaling down, instead of having whatever, like I said, 15, 16 carrier battle groups, and you're going to use those, then it is more economical and maybe provides that support for the other parts of the strategy, these small dispersed forces on islands that are moving around. Yeah, maybe that all fits together nicely. It ain't cheap, though.
Right. Right. Tim?
I was just going to observe that the Quad, which is a cooperation agreement between India, Australia, Japan, and us, the Quad is most active right now in the Southern Pacific area in wooing countries like Vietnam, specifically Australia and India. And so it's interesting to see the attention of the world also focusing on China, because quite frankly, it's not a task I believe is appropriate for us to address unilaterally. And I don't think we'll be working in a unilateral framework. But Japan, India, and Australia, that's a pretty tight crew. I mean, that's you would assume there's capabilities there, you know, as well as lots of goodwill with those islanders. That's all.
Jeff, any other thoughts? You said you like the idea of the smaller carrier.
Yeah, I mean, this way the high value target isn't so high value. You know, it's like. Like Will was saying, you still need that America class thing. It's like 3,000 sailors, and you know, that's a big. You lose a lot of capability. You lose one of those. But if you have things broken up, that's the whole point of the 500 ships, particularly with a lot of them being drone ships. Is you know, you don't. There's not such a strategic loss when you lose certain ships. The more of them you have, and the more your resources spread out. But that makes them less effective when they're spread out too. It's the conundrum of mass, you know, vice dispersion, and you know. So as long as that's recognized, you know, I suppose it's all right. I like the idea of like Tim was saying about the COAD. The idea of wooing those countries, like India particularly and Vietnam. They're in a good position to parry China's moves, you know. I mean, China's like their brand kind of is like taking a hit here. I mean, there's a lot of people I think on this earth who think that China basically attacked the rest of the world with this virus, and you know, so it's like I think there's a lot of people willing to be allied against them who might not have, you know, before this thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't think that Australia doesn't need any encouragement. They've kind of butted heads with China, and I don't think they need any encouragement. India certainly is, you know, in the middle of crowbars and people being thrown off the cliffs on their border with China, and I don't think they're under any illusion. And so I think it's going to take American leadership, and I mean financially, by putting. You know, by saying, yeah, we intend to build the Navy, we intend to be there, and in that way we will deter it. But the lead story, or one of the major stories today in the early bird, is the National Security Advisor, right? He's talking about Taiwan, right? And so I'll read you a paragraph, and I want you to, so let's kind of meld these two together. The U.S. National Security Advisor warned China on Wednesday against any attempt to take Taiwan by force, saying amphibious landings are notoriously difficult, and there was a lot of ambiguity about how the United States would respond. Robert O'Brien told an event at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas that China was engaged in a massive naval buildup probably not seen since Germany's attempt to compete with Britain's Royal Navy prior to World War I. Part of that is to give them the ability to push us back out of the Western Pacific and allow them to engage in an amphibious landings on Taiwan. The problem with that is that amphibious landings are notoriously difficult, pointing out that the 100-mile distance between China and Taiwan and also the paucity of landing beaches on the island. Now, paucity means scarce, okay? Yeah. Just so everybody knows. I know Will knew that, but I just wasn't sure that Tim and Jeff did. I'm curious your thoughts on that, Will. Will's actually shooting me some video of his. Are you in your basement, Will? You have a nice looking basement there, bud.
No, that's the living room. I was messing with Skype to see if I could get my connection better. So just pushing all the buttons.
Well,
sorry.
No, it was great. We should probably do this on YouTube live, and everybody can we could all put our mugs on there. Oh, there's Tim.
There you go.
Nice glasses there, Four Eyes.
You know, the statements about Taiwan and this idea of ambiguity is where we should be, because otherwise, if you put a red line out there, then you're daring them to just get right up really close to that red line. And now you're in this discussion, or did they cross the red line? Didn't they? You leave it out there in a sort of unknown, keep them guessing kind of way. And I think it leads to better deterrence, and it also leaves all your options open, so you're not required, out of a pride or honor thing that, well, now you got to respond. And all of a sudden, you got major conflict based on what may have been a pretty minor incident. I'm not sure I get all this discussion about warning them about how difficult amphibious operations are. I'd have to get into that some more to think through that, but I don't know. But the idea of being ambiguous all the way to the point, but also letting them know you're not taking Taiwan by force. I think that's a perfectly good way to put policy out.
All right. Timmy, your thought, the ambiguity? To me, it's like, hey, what's with him? Why is the United States being ambiguous? Why don't we just say it? Why don't we say it with our allies? Hey, if you do this, we will defend Taiwan. Why are we screwing around? Now, Will makes a pretty compelling case for why we would do that. Tim, your thoughts?
Well, I think we had a war in Korea because we were being ambiguous about what we would and would not tolerate. We certainly had an invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein because we were ambiguous about what we were and were not interested in doing. I like being unambiguous, and I don't think there's any reason we should hesitate to say we will definitely fight for Taiwan. I think from listening to Grant, there's more and more countries recognizing them, and I wish we would too.
By the way, we just told Taiwan your military budget isn't big enough, and earlier this week, right? So
yeah, that's how we negotiate these days. I like it. It's a nice start.
Well, I mean, it is. It's to me, it should be with American leadership. Say, hey, look, here's where we see this thing in 2030, 2045. And going forward, we're going to get our Navy to this. We need Japan. We need you to make a similar stride, right? And be able to, right? And then we're going to evolve our ability to command and control so that we can do this jointly. Is it joint or combined? I can't remember. Joint is internal. Combined is outside. So whatever the fuck it is. And the same thing with India, with the same thing with Australia. And then, Vietnam and the Philippines, you guys just do what you can, right? But we are essentially the Quad. But again, in conjunction with the United Kingdom and France, who would support in marginal ways. But these are the free nations of the world that should be guaranteeing this. A free nation on this planet doesn't get overrun by a totalitarian state. So the ambiguity thing doesn't work for me. Why is the most powerful nation? But again, I agree kind of with Will in terms of the red line. We'll make it a crimson line, and it's going to be blurry and kind of opaque, whatever. But make no mistake about it, that ain't happening. And to me, the deterrence is in, if we build this, right, it's peace through strength. It's a historical fact. When you're weak or, seen as, yeah, we can do that, and you're ambiguous, to me, that's how bad things happen historically. So, Jeff?
Jeffrey? I agree with that about, and Jeff, I agree with Tim Jeff, about the
end. Jeffrey?
Yes, I'm here.
That's what your mother calls you, right, Jeffrey?
Yeah, everybody on that side of my family calls me that. Matter of fact, there's a paucity of people on the DePasquale side who call me Jeff. So
there is.
Meaning not many. I learned that from you. Otherwise, I wouldn't know what that word meant. Posse, I thought it meant like a person who urinates in their pants a lot.
I was hoping you'd be insulted by that.
Well, let me just tell you, I think Mr. O'Brien should give that a brief to the Marine Corps about landing beaches and especially the guys who do procurement, so they wouldn't make mistakes like getting the America and other amphibs that don't have any amphibious capability. They're nothing more than fucking helicopter platforms. Like, you know, so I think that needs to be stressed. You know, the enemy is always wondering where you're going to come in any conflict. When you don't have the ability to do surface amphib ops, that means it narrows it down for them, you know? Right. So, yeah, I just make that comment. I wonder sometimes if, you know, if some of the things we're ostensibly saying to foreign countries, not really saying to our own folks. Again, it's like a big, when you talk about ambiguity, I don't know what the fuck our national strategy is when it comes to this. No one's laying it out. There's little, like, we got the Marine Corps came out with their thing. You know, no more snipers, no more tanks, and a lot of, you know, stuff that we don't have yet. And then now the Navy's coming up with this, you know, 500 ship Navy where, you know, with less sailors than we had before. I mean, somebody needs to tie it all together. What's the, you know, what's the overall strategy of this thing?
So, and then here's another question. And so where does that leave us currently? Oh, kind of fucked.
Yeah. What if something happens like now? Everything that happens now, you know, it doesn't, oh wow, I'm in the future. Things don't look good. No, it's like, I'm here and now. You know, it's like the Poles are probably thinking, man, if they only attacked us in 1949,
exactly,
we'd have got all their horses and had some tanks, you know?
we'd have been there right with them. Yeah. Hold on. Here's an email. Mac, I'm curious. Any more thoughts? I enjoyed the discussion about operational excellence. And you guys are spot on in terms of, it's not discussed. All these other things are discussed. But the more I thought about your discussion, the more disturbing it is to me that we're having mid-air collisions in broad daylight over something that's supposed to be an assumed capability. Is it that bad? Question mark. So have you had any other thoughts about operational excellence in the last week? Will?
I think we laid out sort of a disturbing case and how we all feel about it. I don't think it gets any better. You know, and here we are when we're talking about the Navy, we're talking about hardware again. And I don't know, maybe this is also a recognition by the SecDef that it's easier to get robots to do what you want and not worry about people. I have no idea. But of these 500 ships, how many of them are going to be robots? 20%? Maybe it makes it easier to command and control that way. And you don't have to try. I don't know. I am still pessimistic at best about the state of readiness and the state of the leadership in regards to recognizing if they have a problem or not.
Tim, any additional thoughts on operational excellence or discussion about that?
Yeah, I do, and it refers to that F-35 incident specifically. I don't think there's a chance in hell that an F-35 pilot pancaked the bottom of a refueler. I that has got to be a mechanical glitch. Those guys, and I guess gals now too, they're way too well trained to do that. I can't see that being pilot error. Which brings me to my next observation, which is, I hear all about drone ships and AI and whatnot. I'll be very interested to see how an unmanned AI ship survives a typhoon. I have serious doubts that we have built a robust enough architecture inside these ships that they can survive some of the things that they're going to run into out there in the Pacific. That's just an observation. I'm sure someday we will, but it's hard to believe that we're there now.
Hey, let me tell you, I was on the Ranger, and we went to the fucking Midway, couldn't go to Team Spirit in 1987. And we were deploying for 6 months in on the, I think, July 1st of 1987. So we had just done our ready X. We come back into port. It's like March, and we get told you're going to Team Spirit. Like, no, we're not. We're deploying in like 3 months. Oh yeah, but for like, you know, 2/3 of that time, you're going to support Team Spirit because the Midway can't go because the blisters that they put on to correct the list of the ship and give it a level landing deck. They're not functioning right. And so it's going back into dry dock. You're like, fuck, I hate the fucking Midway. I won't even go on it in San Diego. And so so we go head to the Northern Pacific, right? Northern Pacific in the spring is like hell. I thought that the Ranger, 1,000-foot aircraft carrier, was going to snap in half. It was the power of Mother Nature. Holy shit. Yeah. And so I've seen that. And then, you know, the guys on our destroyers and the frigates, they were getting tossed around like a tempest in a teapot. And it was amazing.
Yeah, we busted out of the Philippines to get to Panama and went right through a typhoon. I mean, intentionally right through it. On a goddamn LHA. Oh my god, that was just. I mean, for 4 days they didn't serve any food or anything. I mean, because the ship was just it was unbelievable.
Yeah, and the amphibs are flat bottoms and they don't take heavy seas well at all. So
that would be like, whoa. Oh yeah, the LST guys they were suffering.
I was watching. So
me and Will were on the Spartanburg County. I'll tell you what. I think the fucking Santa Maria and the Nina and the Pinta had smoother rides across the Atlantic than we did.
They can't be as bad.
I was watching I don't know what I was doing up on the bridge. I used to spend a fair amount of time up there for different reasons, but it was interesting watching the ship be, you know, a carrier be driven and shit. I thought that was kind of intriguing. But so I'm up there and I'm looking. I'm out on one of the wings, and I look, and I'm looking at the, you know, the destroyer that follows an aircraft carrier called the Plain Guard, right? And you should see this son of a bitch. I'm like, it's going to roll over at some point. There's no way. I mean, this thing is like going left and right and left, and just like, holy shit, man. You know, Mother Nature, man. If you've never seen her in her full fucking pissed off regalia, holy shit, man. Anyway, Jeff, did you finish your thoughts on operational excellence? Do you have any more?
Well, you know, it kind of like is connected to like what are you reading now? Because I just finished reading Neptune's Inferno, and the Navy was really they were any kind of bad thing that happened to a ship, somebody's going to pay in those days, and whether it was. I think there's a lot of unjust reliefs and unjust court martials, as a matter of fact, you know, during the Second World War. And even before, I mean, even Admiral Nimitz was court martialed for, you know, running a ship on a sandbar, which is easy to, you know, to correct. So, I mean, it seems like there has to be a yin and yang. There's no sweet spot that can be had between what's appropriate and what isn't when it comes to holding people accountable. I have to tell you, the book Neptune's Inferno, they wanted to court martial the destroyer division commander because he didn't go looking around for survivors after the big battle where we lost Admiral Scott and Callahan, because he said, "Hey, I'm all that's left. You know, we need to get up here and block any Japanese counter move." And I think his career was still ended. So, it's a constant yin and yang between things. But it's better to be on the side of being tough, I guess, than it is on the side of being lax, for sure.
Yeah, I again.
Lax means defeat, you know?
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. How do you spell it?
It's spelled P-A-U-S-C-I-T-Y. Lax.
I see all of this, and I thought Will kind of laid it out when we talked about it the first time. When you link these things together, you know, what it points to. And again, if you want to in terms of operational excellence. I cringe at what's going to come out of the investigation into the how a United States Navy warship built to contain damage burns for 5 days in a U.S. port. I cringe to think what's going to come out of that. Can we not?
And arson attacks.
Arson is the origin, and can we not do damage control 5 compartments outside the fire anymore to save the ship? And it burns to its hull. All you have to do is read the investigations of the USS Fitzgerald to see the problems that the Navy's dealing with now. And it's years of neglect, and it's this same fight that they're having right now, which is our primary concern, operational excellence or all these other things, all these other issues, your tuition assistance, your GI Bill, right? Diversity, what's important? Well, all those other things can take place in the appropriate context, but you have to be operationally excellent. And what you see, the picture painted by the Fitzgerald, by the McCain, by the Bonhomme Richard, by the special operations community in the United States Navy, is a broken, malfunctioning organization. And I mean, read the investigation into the Fitzgerald. It's disgusting. And people died that day, that night. People died on the McCain less than 2 months later because the fucking CO of the ship did not set the ship's sea and anchor detail going into Singapore through the Malaccan Straits, and the sea and anchor detail are the most experienced navigators. They're the most experienced helmsmen, blah, blah, fucking blah. The XO recommends it. He says, nah, we don't need to do that. And they drive into another fucking ship. And you're like, and it's just like, you got to be shitting me. So anyhow, I think the Marine Corps is in, and I think the Army, you know, it's the American military that's dealing with this. And when you're not operationally excellent, and I'm not talking about operationally better than the shitheads you're fighting against, that will get you marginally better, you know. But when you're not excellent like we should be, when you can't drive ships, when you can't refuel, and Timmy, here's a question for you. Why do you think that it was hardware error when we just saw it was pilot incompetence off the coast of Japan?
Because of the screening that the F-35 pilots go through, they're supposed to be the top 1% of all pilot candidates that enter into the pipeline. And my assumption is that something they have no business being directly underneath the aircraft. I doubt that an F-35 is going to be as unprofessional as to try a belly roll after refueling. I've got to believe in something like that it's a mechanical failure, because I just don't see how an F-35 pilot gets underneath a goddamn refueling aircraft.
All right.
They're supposed to be the best we got.
Yeah.
And I got to take them at that.
All right. Well, good luck on that. All right. If you want to whistle past the graveyard, I don't see any indication why you would hope. I could see why you would hope for that. I don't know. I haven't seen anything that would give you any kind of credence.
This is based on nothing but just thinking about it and intuition wise. I just don't see how you end up underneath and smacking into the bottom of an airplane. That to me sounds like something really went haywire with their control surfaces. It's not their fault. I mean, an F-35 pilot is supposed to be the best we got.
Got it. Okay. I want to discuss something, but I don't want to hear Donald Trump's name. I don't want to talk about current political candidates. I want to talk about universities that are no longer places where you can openly discuss things. And I don't mean like Ann Coulter coming on and, you know, Ben Shapiro coming on. I mean that are not forums for intellectual discourse and a liberal arts education. And then you layer on top of that, you err, and let's not talk about the 1619 project. Let's say that there was a 1738 project that said unicorns are, you know, that said unicorns are human beings. And you have a major media outlets, the gray lady of is that the New York Times? I think it is, but of publishing, right? Who is so negligent, I don't know another word, because if you followed this, you know, scholars around the country, have challenged the New York Times relative to the 1731 project and their unicorn riding. And then this week, some scholars said that the Pulitzer Prize awarded for the unicorn project should be rescinded, right? Because the New York Times surreptitiously went into the website after the president called bullshit on him and said, and then surreptitiously edited things out and never said anything. Nothing to see here. And so I don't really – so my question is, as a nation, when your universities aren't providing a liberal arts education but are seemingly have become the hotbed of totalitarian thought and that it's okay to eliminate their right to free speech – and that's being espoused and tolerated on university campuses. And then you see major media outlets in your nation cease to report, cease to separate the function of reporting and opinions, meld those together and become advocates. Where does that take you as a nation? Well, where does when these institutions I think fundamentally depart from their historic role to the point where we have people that say, yeah, fuck your First Amendment rights. It's my responsibility to prohibit you from saying that. And you hear that shit, something that we never grew up with. Where does this take the country ultimately?
Yeah, you know, the founders were deeply thoughtful in political theory, and they had seen things throughout history, and you know they weren't going to have a Bill of Rights because they thought it was so fundamental. But then they got into it and figured out that freedom of speech is crucial. And for people that can't tolerate someone else's speech, that sense of intolerance goes to violence. And violence may not be interpersonal violence first, but there's violence associated with policing someone else's speech because there's a threat of police action, incarceration, and along those lines. And so we want freedom of speech because what we don't want is political violence, particularly in this country. And as I've said on this show probably 100 times, there's 400 million firearms in private hands in this country. You don't want to get to that level of violence, and you don't want to be in a place where, unfortunately, we really are today, that people are afraid to hold what is seemingly a normal viewpoint, in that I differ from you and here's why. And if you can't have that discussion in a university with 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who got all kinds of wacky ideas, what's a better way to learn than to actually discuss with people in a rational, thoughtful way? But if you're not going to start there, then obviously it's never going to happen. Battle lines get hardened, and hardened battle lines are brittle in the society, and the way the nation's founded becomes very brittle. Freedom of speech gives us a flexibility that's gotten through a whole lot, with one major significant hiccup 50, 60 years ago. And that didn't end well, right? I mean, the war got over, but there's 600,000 Americans that are dead. We don't want to go there again. And I think people, they're not playing with fire. They're playing with nuclear weapons, and they don't recognize it.
Timmy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think 3 years ago was when Evergreen College riot happened, where they ran off their professors for refusing to participate in a racial exclusion reverse thing. And at the time, everybody thought that was just a crazy Pacific Northwestern university. But this has been going on in universities for decades. There was a columnist that used to write out of Wilmington, North Carolina, named Mike Adams, who after over a decade and a half of absolutely ridiculing the staff of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, was finally forced to leave and unfortunately committed suicide this last summer. And he used to write very presciently about the dangers of this type of thinking. And just now, because I remember reading a comment where that to the effect that when social justice invades an organization, the organization is doomed. It will not be able to function to its original goals. And when I typed that into Google to see if I couldn't figure out who said that, nothing comes up but encouraging articles about the importance of social justice. And I mean, this goes on for thousands of answers. You can't even find contrary opinions to what is clearly a cancer that is affecting our entire nation. And having thought about this for a while, Mac, I've got to say, you and about, I don't know, I would say conservatively 5,000 to 10,000 other podcasters, because there's a ton of content of people who are like-minded, are the only thing, the only antidote, the only thing that we can say is our media narrative has become so obviously polarized that it's no longer credible to us. And most people are seeking their news and their opinions and whatnot on the exact same way our fans are getting theirs right now. And I think that's all we can do is continue to push back, because there's no question that we've got facts in history and common sense and decency on our side. Of the debate, all we want is a functioning country that guarantees all its citizens their rights. You know, it's pretty simple.
What about, I want to ask you, so now you have the university is an advocate. It's not a place of discourse. It's an advocate. It's not a place of diverse discourse and inclusion. It's an advocate. And really, in my opinion, it is more about excluding certain perspectives and making sure you know this and believes that it should do that now as an activist. And the same thing with the media now believes that should be their role. Do you agree with Will? Do you think that takes us down the road to violence?
It certainly can. I hope not. It's hard for me to imagine we disintegrate to the point where civilians are engaging in wanton use of firearms. I find that very difficult to see us eventually getting that. But sure it does. Right now, the DOD is not going to change until it gets its ass kicked a couple times and is forced to change. We're not going to change our prevailing attitudes until the negative consequences from those attitudes manifest themselves. And I think that they're manifesting themselves now inside of our liberally controlled cities, and it's not a very appealing or appetizing spectacle. My own father will not go out to dinner at his favorite place because it was attacked by protesters. People sitting out eating dinner, my dad's age, enjoying a meal, were attacked by BLM protesters and harassed, and he's not going to tolerate that. I don't think we can have too much of that before there is a lashback, and I don't think the lashback necessarily has to be violent. It just has to be a lashback, a pushback. I just hope it doesn't call for violence, because that would be most unfortunate.
So do you think we're going to see Jarvis on the news anytime soon?
Jarvis is talking to me about what kind of gun he could be carrying, and I'm most distraught because I'm like, Dad, you shouldn't be carrying a gun unless we're going to let me come down and work with you. So no, you won't see him because he's not going out until after the election. Literally, he said that. So no, you're not going to see Jarvis on the news, but it's only a matter of time before you get a gigantic crowd of people acting aggressively to some diners who are carrying and being confronted by multiple hostile adversaries, armed or unarmed, irrelevant. That's a lethal force encounter. You're authorized at that point to defend yourself and your loved ones. And it's just a matter of time. In today's media environment, who knows how that's portrayed? It's going to go probably a lot like that poor kid in Wisconsin who was clearly defending himself. This poor guy. And I hope not to see that. But who knows? I just hope we don't see that, because an armed society is a polite society. You've got to go, you got to do some transgressing down here to start getting people shooting, because everybody's got guns. So I like that. I like everybody having guns because we all seem to be very calm about it, you know?
Right, right. Jeff, your thoughts on the university piece, the and again, the most disturbing relative to the 1731 project is that it's not like the it's not like the Ojai Daily News, right, that's involved in that. It is the New York Times. So your thoughts on these pieces and where it takes us, you know, as a nation.
Right. Well, I mean, when the Bill of Rights was first created along with the Constitution, that's the first time that a government was based, the priority was based on individual liberty. And from the beginning, those guys, the founders, said that this counts, that this is contingent upon a free press that calls balls and strikes as fairly as they can. Now, that was laid out, and you know, we've never really had the type of free press they envisioned. But because there is you know, different wings of the press and everything, we always seem to manage to get by with at least most of the truth eventually getting out to the people. You know, to paraphrase Lincoln, you know, you can fool some of the people all the time and so forth. But almost like white blood cells attack a germ. As soon as that idea got out, I mean, right after our revolution, you had the French Revolution, to where there's a belief, and it's common in academia, that equality and personal liberty can't coexist, even with a free press. That you got to choose one or the other. That the person's right to express themselves and to take advantage of those liberties set forth in the first part of the Bill of Rights will infringe on the drive for equality. And so what happened is you came up with socialism, first starting in the 1820s and really getting rolling with, you know, in academia. In academia is where that stuff started. You know, mediocre professors like Karl Marx.
Right.
Saying this, like white blood cells attack a germ, they attack the idea of personal liberty and people being able to do and say what they want, and the idea of being able to express your ideas openly and let the mass of, you know, of people make their own decisions on it is an anathema to them, because you know, they'll might lose. These people aren't smart enough to know what's good for them. You know, it's kind of like a perversion of Plato's Republic, where there's this elites that kind of run things, and they're just kind of elite because, you know, they're better and smarter and so forth. And now that's defined by attendance at some of the, you know, the ivory palaces in academia, like our Ivy League schools and so forth, to where now that type of disease has made it that they will tolerate no dissent from what they define as being the right way to think. And that is a shifting target. And the irony is, a lot of times you find people who are like the, you know, the icons of this thing, like Larry Summers is the first guy that comes to mind, you know, the Democrat who worked for Bill Clinton and so forth. You know, they can get pilloried. They can get hoisted on their own petard. I mean, that's a French Revolution lesson right there. And that's what we're going through now. And it's pushed its way into, you know, not only academia, but academia feeds journalism. And so consequently, they're all of a piece. They know what's right and we don't, you know. And so consequently, you got newsworthy things not being reported or being reported in a skewed way. And so it's something that if you're aware of, that's something we really got to fight. I mean, I think one of the things that should happen in our society is And I think, you know, the rise of the internet may help this. The idea that brick and mortar universities that define what's the right way to think and what's the wrong way to think crumble and go away. I mean, when the government is financing some of these institutions, that guarantees that they'll never be non-corrupt. So I think the only hope is, you know, and I'm not the type of guy who you know, lays, you know, his stake by technology, but I think the idea that anybody can learn anything now because, you know, because of the access to knowledge and stuff is important. And the danger is that is being controlled now. The guy who controls Facebook, for instance, is the guy who invented Facebook so he could get girls. This nerdy dude, you know, who now decides what we read and what we don't on that platform. And then the other platforms that do the same thing, and particularly and most perniciously, Google, because Google's super convenient. If you can't get the truth in Google, you know, here we go back to the library and dig out the Funkin' Wagnalls and the encyclopedias. Right.
Yeah. You know, the it's just disturbing. And when you look at, you know, how did it get this far? And, you know, one of the things that Mike Musselman used to say about Will, about getting things done, was, you know, he said he learned something from Will. He said, just do it and take control of it. Nobody's going to push back. Will, would you like to explain? Was there, can you provide context to that?
I think that was Musselman's excuse to just do whatever the hell he wanted whenever the hell he wanted to do.
That is a fact, the way he behaved. And so maybe he was citing you. But there is some truth to it, right?
I learned something from John Allen, of all people. And John Allen used to say, hey, when the music stops and you're going to be holding the steaming bag, i.e. you're going to be accountable, and you know that, then take charge in the beginning and don't wait for a bunch of other people. And he was pretty adept at that. And it's something about being a commander. If you're a commander and you're going to be ultimately responsible for everything the unit does and fails to do, and accountability is coming to you, then take charge and lead. And it's amazing how many people are actually, who think maybe they know what's going on, really don't, and are afraid to step up and just do it. I think that's where that came from. Or I just suspect Musselman needed an excuse to go fuck off and do what he wanted to. So
that could be the truth. But when you look at, you know, universities, you know, have been, you know, these cradles for, you know, ideas and discussion and debate. But what was, I would say, the dominant sentiment was the First Amendment and free speech and the right to assemble and all that was kind of sacred. And again, I think the first time I remember seeing, you know, being troubled was the riots in Berkeley when either Ann Coulter or Ben Shapiro went to speak. And it was like, yeah, they're not going to be allowed on campus to speak now. And I remember thinking, holy shit, man. So we're not going to go out of our way to guarantee the right of free speech, the right of and to be devoted to diversity of thought and a vigorous debate. We're going to allow people that would become violent to sway what is going to happen on a campus of higher learning, if you can extend that phrase to the University of California, Berkeley. So, and I remember thinking, wow. And that thing has done nothing but grow and grow and grow and grow to the point that you see this dichotomy in the nation, right? You see that the nation wants to believe what's on social media. That is the chosen narrative. And when the world doesn't line up, right, when the world and facts and evidence and the truth doesn't line up with the narrative on social media, we have riots and looting. And that's where we are today. And then you have universities and you have media promoting a version of the truth that corresponds with the world of social media and isn't loyal to the truth, isn't loyal to truly diverse discourse. And you're like, there's a reconciliation that's coming, and we're going to learn why, you know, freedom of speech is important. But it's Washington in this country. And again, you saw it last night in Minneapolis, which is going to burn down again. And that is that here's a guy, a cop that was held in confinement for I don't know how many months so he could raise the money to meet his $1 million bail. He's been judged to be not a risk flight and not a danger to himself or others. And if you meet those criteria, guess what? It doesn't matter who you are in the United States of America. You know, you are allowed to be out on bail. So it's interesting to me how far this has moved, right? And then again, this week, you have academics that are standing up that don't tend to be liberal by nature, but academics that are standing up and screaming, hey, this has to stop, man. We're getting annihilated, and we're not books that we've written and worked on years that have gone through peer reviews are not being published because some social, you know, justice warrior doesn't like the discussion of post-colonial XYZ place. And so my book can't be published. What is that reminiscent of? Kristallnacht, you know? And so, again, it's just, to me, pretty amazing then in the United States of America. And then ultimately, where does this take the country? When you can't have an honest discussion, when newspapers like the Times publish complete bullshit, and then nobody – and they're not called out for it because you can't call them out. And I use the example of the NBA ratings are down 45%. Everybody's at home every night. What's going on there? Well, in public, you can't say to LeBron James, unless you want to get your ass fired, hey, LeBron, 45% down? That's more than a margin. Why do you think that 45% of the viewers of the NBA have shut this shit off? Do you think it's because it's become overly political? Nobody's asked that question in public. It's the 900-pound gorilla breathing in the room. Ted Cruz said it, and Mark Cuban, you know, shit all over him for it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I don't know. It's just, I don't want to believe that the nation's headed to violence, but I believe that. And I believe.
You remember Phil Caputo, the author who wrote Rumor of War?
Rumor of War.
He wrote this book called Del Corso's Gallery, which is about a combat photographer in Vietnam and then Beirut. And his observation of Beirut in 1976 was 75-76 was, this is what the end of the world really looks like, because at that point in Beirut it was like faction against faction, people shooting mortars off their roofs, and yet the limping by was still some semblance of an economy. And but basically said, this is what the end looks like: a bunch of armed mobs attacking each other over, you know, different nuances. Now, there in Lebanon, of course, it's religious, right, it's ethnic, you know, and so forth. But I think the point is, it devolves into secularism. Even a mighty nation, you know, can suffer that. And I think that's an issue that's a possibility with our country, especially the fact, like Will said, 400 million guns. I mean, I got three of them myself, and I'm going to get more.
I was musing about, you know, that thing, you know, and I couldn't remember it, but it was written by a guy named a Lutheran pastor by the name of Martin Niemöller, and it says, first they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics. I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then they came for me. And by that time, there was no one left to speak up. And that's kind of the way they phrased it, because the speech that he says that in Germany in 1946 wasn't recorded. But it was so often repeated that it became something, and he tried to recount it as best he could. But to me, if we don't stand up for the First Amendment, to the right of these rights, then I don't know. I don't. Then it goes to violence, right?
Yeah. Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
If I can make an observation, there is some extensive writing justifying the use of the force, military force, in order to make it apparent to civilian populations in revolt, the heirs of their way. And I'm specifically talking about William Tecumseh Sherman, who explained himself to everybody constantly, wrote tons of volumes, and his letter to the mayor of Atlanta, when he ordered them to vacate their houses, was short and blunt and to the point, which was, it's your fault. The only way this will stop is if you declare the errors of your ways and agree to live under the rules of law and preserve the union. Simple. But it's interesting because that's what we should be studying right now is some of his writings, because right now they represent legal precedent in the court systems, as far as I'm aware. I'm sure a lawyer could argue that. But there's a lot of them. And it's interesting because they're very well articulated. And to me, it's like boom, there it is, that this is the price of this kind of ridiculousness. But I just can't see it.
But it's not. But again, to me, the danger is it's not perceived. What you're talking about is perceived as ridiculousness, and because of the way the nation educates now, people have the right to shut you down and to keep you from speaking, right?
Right. Yeah, from speaking, from mentioning the words right. of some historical figure wrote. Yeah, oh, right. Yeah, they don't want
to
hear
they it. Believe right. that. And so to yeah. me, that's what's so discerning. Okay,
And they would say it represents a physical harm to them, that it represents an unsafe space. And that right there is a neural, that's the kind of behavior that you pay psychiatrists to talk you out of. That you use cognitive behavioral therapy so you learn how not to catastrophize every goddamn thing that happens to you. It's literally teaching college graduates to become neurotic, there's been several books written on exactly that by psychiatrists who says, look, you guys are nuts. This is a crazy way to train people to think. It's not healthy.
Right. Right. All right.
Catastrophize. That must be a Jesse Jackson word.
What are you reading, Will?
Yeah. So I finally finished that book on Edison. And
yes.
It's written in reverse order.
And
so I got to the end, which is actually the beginning, and it makes no sense why he wrote it in reverse order. It's a good book. It's about a great American. It's an interesting story. I don't know why he wrote it that way. If I was to read it again, I'd read it backwards. I read another really interesting book that I'd never heard of called Where Away by a guy named George Perry. It's a story of the USS Marblehead, which was a light cruiser in the Asiatic fleet at the outbreak of World War II. And it's written like a novel, but it's actually history. And Marblehead was there. Houston was a heavy cruiser. I think Boise was a heavy cruiser. Marblehead had, I think, 10 or 12 six-inch guns, fights in some very initial engagements, and gets bombed to the point that the rudder is stuck and it's going in circles. And it's a story of how they eventually sailed to Ceylon, got their rudder fixed, or maybe slightly fixed. Then they sailed to South Africa, and then they eventually got back to New York. And you want to talk about operational readiness and competence. The guys had it in spades. The ship was reported sunk however many times. When it was initially bombed, people out of Houston, when they saw it pull into port like a week later, were shocked. They said there's no way that ship could have stayed afloat. So it's called Where Away. It's about 300 pages, a great book.
Where Away.
Where Away by George Perry.
W-E-A-R?
Where is in the W-H-E-R-E. Where Away.
Got it. All right.
And then I just started that Ian Toll series on the Pacific, and I echo what Tim said. This is an absolutely phenomenal book. And I like to think I've read a lot about the Pacific, but just his chapter on Pearl Harbor, there's things in there that I had never heard, never known before. Really interesting. I got a feel, I didn't get into the footnotes, but I think he got into some, archives, that veterans did long after the event that maybe are just sort of coming to light, because he's got some great anecdotes, but he weaves it in a really nice readable style. Absolutely phenomenal book.
Give us one morsel since you've just gone through it. Give us one morsel of something that you didn't know about Pearl Harbor? Because now it's like, fuck, now I got to read this thing.
So Enterprise is at sea.
Right.
When the attack goes, and they don't know where the Japanese are, so they send planes here, planes there, planes everywhere. They can't find them. And there's a squadron of fighter planes that are aloft that basically go bingo for fuel. They can't get back to the carrier. So they send them back to Hickam the night of December 7th. And the tower knows how trigger happy everyone is on the ground, because the people on the ground actually think the Japanese are going to invade.
Right.
And they go to extraordinary lengths to tell everyone, these are Americans coming in. They got their lights on. They're on a standard approach, et cetera. And it doesn't mean anything. And I think 5 out of the 6 planes get shot down landing at Hickam Field the night of December 7th. Friendly fire. And I think 1 or 2 pilots survived. So some of the whatever 3,000 Americans killed in action on December 7th were those pilots and those fighter planes that flew off Enterprise and got shot down by Americans at Pearl Harbor. And I'd never heard anything about that. But he gets into the mindset that was going on in Pearl Harbor on the afternoon of December 7th and into that evening and the next day. Really interesting stuff.
Awesome. So two thumbs down on writing books backwards to forward, front to back.
Yeah, crazy.
Back to front. All right. I've been waiting for that, just so everybody knows. just no shit, man. I want to know. Timmy, what are you reading?
Before I get started on that, I just want to add one from that story when Halsey gets in about 1 o'clock in the morning and goes up to the Admiral's place. Kimball and the Army General are looking at maps, trying to defend on what they were reportedly dealing with was a glider-borne invasion by Japanese troops. And Halsey goes, he doesn't have any gliders on that goddamn carrier. He's long gone, and stormed out of there. That's another one of those anecdotes that I've never heard. That I like it, though. But I took the recommendation of one of our listeners and found a copy of Education for Death, The Making of a Nazi. And this is cool because it's hard to find. But apparently the book I got was a class – was printed as a school book for the St. Jerome School in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, which I take it at the time was a large woman's school. It's now a homeschooling outfit. And check this out. There's a 4-paragraph note to the students before the prologue. I'm going to read one of them. This is hysterical. For the sake of holy purity, we have removed 2 paragraphs from page 128. They simply gave a little more graphic detail than we want our students to contemplate. These paragraphs describe the immodest attire and behavior of young Nazi ladies. From this, we can see how a lack of purity in both dress and behavior can easily lead to grave sins of the flesh. Similar things are being taught in our American schools today. Let us take away from this the importance of protecting the forgotten virtues of purity. And also, we removed the very last chapter of the book because they reflected the author's personal Protestant ideals. That's hysterical that this is being taught to school children in 1941, but it's a good book. I just found the way that I found it. It was amazing because there's not that many of them. The hardbacks are real expensive.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's hard to find. Yeah, but it's an interesting book. I mean, it's interesting, but I just can't get over the note to the reader. That's just is priceless.
What and give everybody the title of that book again?
Education for Death, The Making of a Nazi, written by Gregor Zimmer, who was the president of the American school in Berlin throughout the 1930s, up until the time they left in 40. And he came back. This was a school book printed for those girls in Wisconsin in 1941. So I believe his book was out in 1940.
Got it. All right. Jeffrey, what are you reading?
Well, I finished reading Neptune's Inferno. What a great book. And 3 things I want to bring up about it real quick. The first thing is one of the heroes of this book to me is Admiral Scott, who is he gets the Guadalcanal. He realizes the epistemology, you know, how the Navy thought they were going to fight the war through the 20s and 30s was you know, was different fighting the actual Japanese with a mirror image type fleet. And so he actually scored some the first victory that we had in Guadalcanal naval-wise in late October, early November of 1942. And then one of the admirals who worked for Admiral King, a guy named Callahan, was sent there to Pacific, and he just took over. And yet they kept Scott in kind of like a you know, superfluous position in the same fleet, you know. And and these guys went to war, and Callahan and Scott, and they went and they attacked the Japanese up the slot. And the thing that really jumps out at you, the whole geography of the Guadalcanal area, the good deal they had by having planes on Henderson Field and Guadalcanal, but then the challenges of going through the slot between Tulagi and Guadalcanal and Savo and all that stuff, and how difficult that was. And when they're pushing up that way, and these guys, Callahan, who only had an academic really knowledge of what was going on, no real practical experience, but even so, in command, he pushed aggressively up there at night. And they engaged the Japanese, confident in the fact that they thought their surface ships, you know, gun to gun, could defeat the Japanese. And they did. But those two guys got killed doing it, though. And then the next thing was Admiral Halsey, who was takes over from Gormley, who was, basically relieved because his attitude was getting worse by the day. As far as being actually defeatist, they put Halsey in there. And one of the first things Halsey does, he orders another drive up the slot, this time using the battleships, but they'd been hoarding these things. And the idea was, this is stupid. You know, it's hard for the battleships to navigate, you know, and still maintain the SOP, pickets and so forth, the destroyers and cruisers. And, but this guy, they went up there, and the guy who was in charge of these was a guy who's kind of like Admiral Lee was his name. And he was kind of looked at in he was like a nerd when it came to radar, you know. And for most of the gunnery, I mean, these guys, these surface ship guys, were into ballistics and gunnery. And the whole thing, though, really wasn't much different than what we were teaching lieutenants at TBS, you know. Okay, add 200, drop 100, add 50, fire for effect. And you didn't have to do that shit with radar. And this guy Lee, you know, kind of like camouflaged himself behind two burning hulks, worked out solutions, because he drilled his guys in this use of radar and everything. And he had the second salvo they shot was hits on Japanese battleship. And we won that one too. So, you know, I was just impressed with the idea of doing this thing, you know, fighting a war at full speed and at the same time not really knowing how to use your own technology yet. And learning on the fly. And then the last thing I want to talk about or just mention was the Sullivan brothers on the USS Juno. The Juno sunk and all the Sullivan brothers died. Five guys from one, all the boys in the Sullivan family. And but according to survivor accounts, kind of like what you guys were talking about with the new accounts, you know, in regards to Pearl Harbor, survivor accounts, the last one to die was the oldest brother, who was actually had some rank. He was a chief petty officer, and he was going insane from dehydration and exposure, like so many were. You had people who would like walk off rafts, and that's what he finally did. He stripped down naked and he said, "I'm gonna go for a bath." But up to that point, besides the mania trying to look at every dead body that was soaked in oil, he'd like clean off the face to see if it was one of his brothers. And at first, he was highly rational, and he was kind of like a bulwark holding this little group of survivors together on a couple of life rafts. But eventually, he too died. It's just a poignant thing that up till last, he was quoting naval regulations to the other survivors in these lifeboats. At the same time, every time they came across either badly wounded people floating or even dead bodies, he'd check them to see if they were his brothers. And so that book by these guys, that especially following on Last Stand the Tin Can Sailors, you know, it's got me. I guess I'm behind the curve because I'm trailing you guys. You guys read these before me, and I'm going to be reading the Toll books next. I guess I can't see though how they can compete with these last two. They're just outstanding.
the no, you know, you can you read those stories of the World War II Navy and you're in awe, right? Yeah. And I don't care if you're talking about the seamanship that it took to crew that ship that Will's talking about back to port and get through all of that. You know, how the hell did you do that? And how do you figure it out? How do you do that? And so, again, the Navy, you know, you read about it from World War II and just an unbelievable, you know, tough organization. And no, it's, again,
you know, a lot of those ships that were in those battles, they did friendly fire against each other, you know, accidentally. Because right. It was just, you know, identifying, you know, ships in the dark like that, where, you know, it's momentarily, you know, illuminated by gun flashes and stuff. You know, there are ships that were actually at war with each other when they got to Libo ports because they had fired each other up. And, you know, that's another thing that's a tragic, you know, facet of the whole thing. But
well, no, you know what? I've wondered about that because you watch World War II film, right? And now they've been turned into videos, and you see a Japanese kamikaze attack, and so it's attacking somebody in that's part of the fleet, and as this thing comes down low, you see all these guns from this entire huge battle group, you know, follow this thing, and you're thinking, oh shit, man, do people have a left and right lateral limit? Because it doesn't look so because of shit's going everywhere. And and that metal winds up someplace, right?
You're right. The ghastliness of it is another thing. You know how we watch guys do FOD walks,
yes,
on LZs and
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
And on the carrier decks. Well, they're doing dead body walk, dead body part. FOD is hands and feet and legs and arms and stuff. And guys are throwing pieces of human beef, you know, off the ship. So, you know, it wouldn't follow the flight decks and some of those carriers or just the regular decks, you know.
Gruesome.
So it's like the ghastliness of it, you know, these huge shells being – I mean, we're talking stuff bigger than any Marine Corps artillery ever had, except, I mean, average naval rifle, 8-inch, you know, and that's our biggest arty piece. And yet they talk about what it's like to get hit by 14-inch Japanese guns and so forth, and hitting other people with 16-inch guns. I mean, that's what this guy Lee was doing, almost direct fire with a 16-inch gun, using burning hulks to camouflage his movement. A master ship, fighter at sea, I think.
Right. No, I mean, the initial, you know, shots into the Johnson, I think, are from, 14, 18-inch guns, and they pass right through because the Johnson's bulkheads aren't heavy enough to set it off. And so, luckily, instead of blowing the shit out of it, they passed right through it. And the Johnson, you know, lived to fight for a few more hours. But no, I mean, it's just humbling, you know, when you read that stuff. All right, boys.
Yeah, and the Marine Corps, like we'd say, the Navy dumped us on Guadalcanal and ran, and we had to win by ourselves. The truth is, the Navy did; they lost a battle, but then they came back and saved the Marines. That's the truth of it, you know.
Right. Well, hey, don't. We don't let the facts get in the way of a good story, right? That's something we as an organization never do. All right, boys, interesting conversation. I would just say this to everybody that's listening. If you're not alarmed by what you see relative to the First Amendment, relative to articulate and inclusive discourse in this country, no matter what political party you're a part of, you need to get your head out of your ass. Because we have a problem in this country. And the problem is this. In a nation of laws, in a nation of freedom, right, it isn't what you read on Facebook and Twitter. You have to go investigate it and get to the truth. And that's what – that's, you know, Frankl's saying, right? The statue of liberty should be balanced with the statue of responsibility. That's your responsibility as a citizen. And if we won't do that collectively – then I believe we are headed for violence. And it's not going to be pretty when it happens. And there's going to have to be a whole bunch of people that get killed unnecessarily because people won't stand up now, right, with these words. They first came for the communists, right, that end with, and then there was nobody left when they came for me. And so to me, that's not the way a democracy works. and there's some issues in our democracy that we have to address. And if we won't address them because of just the partisan stupid bullshit in this country, then we're failing, right? We're failing generations of Americans who've lived under that and who died underneath that, and we're failing our nation. And so get your head out of your asses. So with that said, appreciate the conversation, boys. Very good.
Hey, man, have a great day, Mac.
All right.
Thanks. See you, Mac.
Bye. See you. There you have it. The Mensa brothers. That's right. Here on a at their best, I might add. At their best. You know, sometimes they don't always strike you as the smartest people, but today today they certainly do. And you can see how much somebody sent me a note the other day. Do they really read that much or are they bullshitting? I said, oh no. They're readers. They're readers. So anyway, have a great day. Hour one, I talk about these things because they weigh on me. In hour one, the fall of the New York Times as a, I don't know if you want to call them a thought leader in the nation, to simply a partisan hack piece of shit that peddles things that they believe are important to some narrative. And they're failing the nation. They're failing the nation. And then you layer that on top of universities. That now are not the vigilant custodians of freedom of speech. They become the grounds where people are indoctrinated that it's okay to silence them. Right? Where I think all of us grew up with, yeah, I don't like very much what they're saying, but I'll defend their right to say it. That's not the way it is anymore, and that ought to concern everybody. And I will just say this from a very very, from a very very, unlikely source, and that is academics in tweed jackets with pipes. You're seeing the moral courage to stand up and speak out against this totalitarian-like cancel culture that is coming for everybody who has an idea that doesn't coincide with a version of events that exists on Facebook and Twitter that isn't subject to the harsh scrutiny of the sunlight but is protected and shove down people's throats. And I don't know how it ends if you won't do that other than very violently. And I would say not just once violently, but multiple times until people get it through their head. So until whoever in the future is the Speaker of the House condemns violence along with whatever party owns the White House, and that it is irrelevant which party actually owns it, but people stand up for the right things. And maybe someday we can have a government like that. But until we do, you have to stand up and you have to tell the truth. And so, no, I enjoyed the discussion today. Anyway, have a great day. I talk about that in hour number one. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. As somebody who does it on a regular basis, two questions. Can I talk to you? And you know there's nothing wrong with you, right? And I'd like to share something with you. And then pull out those three goals and Ten Commandments. And those two questions will open the door. And the truth will keep the door open. Because people load people that are struggling full of bullshit. Time heals all wounds. There's a purpose in this. You may not understand it. The Lord works in mysterious ways. All that bullshit. So they're in that dark place. Surrounded by that trite phraseology, and you can be their guide to a better place, to a great place, to a place of transformation. So don't be afraid to do that. So on a Thursday, have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow. All Marine Radio out.